On this episode of Warbird Radio Presents, we sit down with a World War II era A-20 pilot who flew over 60 missions in the South Pacific. Stay tuned. Warbird Radio Presents, The Edward Cassidy Story, starts now.
Those pictures neat. I just love those pictures. That whole flight of A-20s there.
In downtown Macon, Georgia, just behind the federal courthouse, there's an old parking garage. The sign on the building reads Cassidy's Parking. Now, the letter R is missing, but years of sunlight have managed to create one by fading the brick around where the old sign used to be. Like most things in Macon, you can tell this building is old. Really old. I mean, it has gravitas that only old buildings can have. Now, the locals will tell you that when Sherman's troops left Atlanta, they fired one cannon shot at Macon, just up the street from where this parking garage is located. But then they kept on marching towards Savannah. The city was spared. Macon's one of those rare old southern towns where buildings still stand from the Civil War and even earlier. It's a grand old city, to say the least, and the center of the Old South. Now, I go into all of this because, just like the old city of Macon, the man who runs Cassidy's Parking, Edward Cassidy, is also a grand old man as well. He was a fighter pilot in World War II. He flew P-40s and A-20s in New Guinea. And today, inside his garage, he's agreed to share his story with us. So pull up a rocking chair and grab some sweet tea and get comfortable. Here now is Mr. Cassidy.
My father started the business in 1915. And there's been a Cassidy on this corner every day since then.
And there are no plans to stop anytime soon, are there?
Your son's standing behind you here.
we're just doing long.
You flew A-20s in World War II, and we have some pictures here in a wonderful book. Tell me about that airplane. What did you think of the A-20?
Well, my history with that is I went over as a flying fighter, P-40s. And after we were over there doing P-40 work, flying fighters and all like that, then this is my assumption. They needed low level. And they had these A-20s over there that, and I don't know how they got over, but they were over there. So they chose to change our group from a fighter group to a low-level strafing and put in A-20s.
Now, where were you located? Tell the folks where over there was.
Started in Port Moresby, mm-hmm. And worked up the
New Guinea.
Worked up New Guinea. Push it, and the Australians were on the ground. They were the ground people. And they were pushing the Japanese on up New Guinea and pushing them supposedly back home.
Right.
But anyway, it was, and the Australians, see, the only way you could supply over there was by plane. You couldn't go through the jungles. In fact, that's what got us. A supply plane would come and land and unload the gasoline.
That's all they were bringing you guys.
Yeah, that was what they were bringing. Anything, anybody. That was the first thing gasoline was.
So you have a bunch of old DC-3s or C-47s landing in there bringing gas?
What do we call them? DC-3s.
The old Goonie Bird.
Were doing all the doing.
So you're out there in New Guinea with all these Australians on the ground. We have a lot of listeners in Australia. That must have been a really wild time.
Oh, it was. It was that you were out there, and that was it. There wasn't anybody to call to help you or anything like that. But the Australians couldn't get supplies, and that's why what we did a lot of times was flying cover when I was flying the P-40s. we were flying cover so that the Australians could move on the ground, and they'd move on up.
This is a big difference between the P-40. I mean, you're talking about
an
airplane that was designed in the 30s with the P-40 and then the A-20 here with twin engines and lots of power.
Yeah, a lot of power. And the thing about it is I never had twin engine training. And they gave us the pilots that wanted to stay in with the group, and it would be a group, A-20 group. They made up in flying A-20s. And or you could go with a fighter group that was on the island, 49th Fighter. A few fellas went over, but I stayed with the A-20s and the group that was the squadron I was in. And I'm glad I did, because the A-20, it was a great airplane. Honestly, it was just...
What did you like about it?
The speed, the way it handled, and that type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you see what we did with the strafing. We had 6 machine guns shooting out the nose. So we had to do strafing with them.
Nobody wanted to get in front of you.
No, but it was nice. And another thing that I liked, it was just a gunner and me in that plane, 2 people. Now, the fighters I liked, but they were just 1 person, and you didn't have to worry about somebody else.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed A-20s.
Did you know this airplane, the Sweet Virginia May? That was one in your outfit, more than likely.
No, I don't remember.
You know, it's funny, these pictures that I brought you, as I told you before we did the interview here, growing up, my father had a friend who flew A-20s, and all we knew is that he flew in Papua New Guinea. And I brought you these pictures, and lo and behold, you said, that's my outfit.
388th was my squadron.
Excuse me.
No, that's fine.
162, 361, 374.
That's amazing. We have a book here that we're looking at. Tell me about this book. This book was a reunion book, I guess, from your squadron.
Each year. It goes all the way through, and I was never so surprised in my life after all these years for it to come.
It finally showed up. You paid for it a number of years ago.
Figured it was gone. The money was gone. I didn't worry about that.
These pictures were taken from his plane.
From your father's airplane?
Wow. He has the copies at home, and this is where the boy was going in the water, and that's, of course, this is where he hit, and that's where he crashed. They came over the mountain, and this is where he was hit. And his plane was right up here. This was not his plane. His plane was further up in front. I'm assuming they came over in a row over the top of the hill and said it was his boy's first place.
You didn't know you had a badass for a father, did you?
Hot fighter pilot.
Tell me about this mission. Do you remember much about this? These pictures on the website, but this whole incident here, what was going on?
The pictures were taken from your plane.
And these were in, what's the magazine? It was put out during the war. It was an Army plane, Army magazine.
It was before my time. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Probably like the Stars and Stripes.
Stars and Stripes are one of those, probably.
Well, what we did, what happened, that we think, the fella that was leading this flight, it was a river up here. And we were coming down the river, and that's what we did a lot of times, because over there in New Guinea, when they heard planes coming, they could pinpoint them because there wasn't any place for us to be coming to bomb.
Right, right.
And they'd be watching the thing like that.
The Japanese knew you were coming.
The Japanese knew we were coming. And we think, now this is all speculation, that this boy was coming up and we were coming down the river. And down in the river thing and up. And he didn't bring his planes down when he came up, when he came over. And that's when it came in.
Stayed too high and got hit then.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it looks like the bomb bays are open. Were you bombing back over here, back along the river?
As far as I remember, we were bombing this area.
These pictures are just amazing to see this, though.
I'm afraid you can see the parachutes. There are the bombs, the parachutes coming down. But obviously, there's some kind of...
So this guy actually was able to bail out of the airplane. No, he wasn't.
No. This is where he got hit.
Nailed.
That's the next picture of him going in the ground, and that's a picture of him hitting the water, and then that's the explosion. This is the plane behind him that almost got caught up in the...
And I'm assuming that the gunner in your airplane took these pictures.
No, when you're going out on a mission like this, one plane, the lead plane, had a camera going out the back.
Yeah.
So they could record. So most of the time it was a CO, I mean the leader, leading the flight.
Well, this was every day for you guys, though. I mean, seeing a friend like this go down was every day.
Yeah, it was. I was right up here somewhere. When I looked back, you could see all this stuff.
What do you tell young folks who come by here and want to hear some of these stories? What's your message to those younger folks?
When I was sitting over there halfway around the world, flying and living in a tent. You ever lived in a tent for 2 years?
No.
I did. Can you imagine? And all your clothes and everything, yes. And every time you moved up the valley, you had to move your tent. And it was up to you. They talk about officers enlisting men and all like that. I don't care what rank you were. If your tent was here and we had to move up, you better keep that tent. That's because nobody's going to put it up for you. So we called it the poor man's war. And then we hear these boys that were over in Europe and they went to the town for had lunch and all that stuff. And there we were over there in the rainy place, rained every day.
Pretty hot too, wasn't it?
Oh, it was hot as the devil.
So your message to all these folks when they come over here and talk to you then, you tell them the way it was, don't you?
Might as well. And it was really unbelievable that a group of Americans, none of us ever lived in a tent, but it was either you learn things, and I learned quickly because I'd been around. We had a group that came and replacement pilots. You know, they were pretty hot. Show these boys what was going on, what to do in this war. Next thing I know, they're coming around. And what had happened, when they went to get their tent to sleep in, to put up, and had to put it up too, it was five persons in there. The supply sergeant didn't have one.
Just happened to not have a tent, huh?
Just happened to not have a tent. And what they had to use was a tarp, truck tarp. They had to sleep in that for about 3 or 4 days. And they had gone in, blowing off and all. And I learned that the supply sergeants were the best people in the world.
You don't want to make the supply guy mad, do you?
No. Because if you went on leave, which we did every once in a while, not often, you always brought a little whiskey back for the supply people. Keep them happy.
That was the secret, huh?
That was the secret.
Well, I'm watching you look through this book, and I'm sure that a lot of these memories kind of come back to you when you look through here. Do you have one that's a happy one that you like to think about, that you'd like to share with us?
A happy one.
For a time of war, I know that's...
A friend of mine had just died the other day. The only feeling, the only thing that you were able to stay there was the people that were with you. Officers and pilots, and all of them, enlisted men and everything else. A person couldn't have gone over there by himself and lived through all that. But it was having the group. It's another one of my tent mates.
This gentleman here, this Waldo Simonson.
Yeah. We were going up the mountain, or going up the valley, and he got too low and hit the top of the mountain. We didn't know he was gone until we got back.
And it was a different war for you folks over there, wasn't
yeah.
it, in New Guinea?
Uh-huh. I'm looking at some of my friends. And you didn't go out. They knew he was gone. And they knew that he had hit the top of this mountain. And they knew he wasn't there anymore. Mm. So there was not a thing of sending out a group to find him and all like that. Find them. And it was awful. I lost 4 tent mates. There were 5 in a tent, pyramidal tent. And I lost 4 tent mates.
Was there ever a point when you were flying the A-20 that you thought you might end up in that same spot?
Yeah. I mean, when you started out, you didn't know what was going to go wrong. You were hoping that you could do all right, but it was another world, I'll put it that way. Being in New Guinea and in the jungles and with the conditions and the mosquitoes and all like that, that was a chore in itself. I liked all of them. I hope they liked me. But that, I think that was over there was the living conditions. And the thing of, I'll tell you this, and it, I wouldn't want it repeated, but this, I went through the war and never saw a dead person. All my friends, well, I lost, and I lost a bunch of them. We lost 12 one day in one flight, and you never saw them again. And they couldn't go after them. I mean, they couldn't go through the jungles. You couldn't go through the jungles anytime. And those people were gone. And the thing about it, though, you knew if they didn't come back, it was two things. If they were able to get down to a river that there was there, if they could land, and over there they had these flat places that just happened to be there, and they were filled with what they call kunai grass, which is a tough grass. And we had a few people, might see it in this. We had one, we were coming back, we were flying, we had 6 hours for gas. We were flying 5-hour missions. So when we got out this time, one time, and got behind weather turned in, and we didn't have any radar or anything like that over there. And they moved, the weather moved in back of us. And it was called Black Sunday. And we lost, I don't know how many planes, more than 12. We lost 12 in one other one. But we lost more than that, and all because of the weather. And when they went down, coming back in the jungles and all, you could never find them.
We need to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll have more from my conversation with Mr. Cassidy. Stay tuned. Warbird Radio presents The Edward Cassidy Story. Will continue right after this.
Sometimes they ask us to get the coffee. This is Warbird Radio.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to the all-new Warbird Radio Live channel. We're happy to be back on the air right across from the runway at Washington Reagan International Airport. Be sure and tune in Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern each week for Warbird Radio Live, followed by a new episode of one of our top-tier shows like the R.C. Scale Builder Show, Hartman and Hines, Over the Front, and the all-new Texas Warbird Report and Wings Over New Zealand Show. Listen, this station is all about community, so please join up with us on Tuesday nights and call in and become part of the fun and part of the family. Thanks again for tuning in, and join us Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Warbird Radio.
Welcome back. On this episode of Warbird Radio Presents, we're talking to Edward Cassidy, a World War II P-40 and A-20 fighter pilot. Here now is Mr. Cassidy.
One of my tent mates, who is he was mayor of a town south of New Orleans at one time. And he came back, and in fact, he was in my flight. And he was running low on gas all over. And he started flying on one engine. There was a question among the pilots, if you had to get in that condition, should you go to one engine for consumption, or should you stay with two engines? My idea was to stay with the two engines because you had more control of your plane. Mm-hmm. If you had to start flying on one engine, which is not easy anyway, and looking for a place to land or get away or something, it was better to stay with the two engines and actually use up the gas. And that's what he did. When he gave out of gas, there was a Kunai field in front of him somehow or another, and he landed. And he and the gunner got out. It took them 18 days coming down the river. They got on a river. And coming down the river, and on the way they were, and everything was in the river. They eat you up, but they got down.
And they made it back to camp. I bet there was a big party that night, wasn't there?
It was. I thought I'd see his picture. But this is a good friend who just died. Another one.
You told me before we started recording, you said that you'd had your last reunion now. There won't be any more.
We don't have any unless somebody picks it up. Mm-hmm. We had two people that ran it for the 40-some-odd years that we had a reunion every year. And I don't think anybody else will pick it up. And actually, we had one reunion up in Connecticut and didn't have but 12 people. And then we had others down, and we had one in Macon.
Did you really?
Yes.
Everybody came here to the garage, huh?
Yeah. I tell you quickly about that.
Yeah.
It's just Little Doc from Atlanta to Piac, where Little Doc was my plane.
Yeah, there it is, Captain Edward T. Cassidy.
Fly Cassidy's.
Now, how did you come up with Little Doc? How did that story come about?
It was my wife's nickname, and I don't know, I think it was from the picture show or something, and we call her Little Doc.
Well, let's talk about that. After the war, you came back here to Macon. And started working for your dad, didn't you?
No.
Fill me in on the story there.
Let me tell you quickly a little bit of history, and then let's see. My father started this business in 1905. He died in 1930, and my mother ran it.
So you came back to work for Mom?
Until we got back.
Yeah.
Until we got the bus. So we've been working all our lives because when we got big enough to work at the garage, we came to the garage and grew up on the corner of First and Pine Street, which you walk down here. It was one of those beautiful homes that never should have been torn down.
Mm-hmm.
We after, that's where my father was when he died. And
Nakin, of course, here for our listeners that are out of the, don't live in the state or even in the country, this is sort of the heart of the Old South, all these beautiful old antebellum homes and everything around here.
Yeah, it is.
So you came back, and you've been working here ever since. And how many kids did you have? I know we've met one of your sons today. Still go to church at St. Joseph's?
Still go to St. Joseph's.
Did you fly anymore after the war? Was that?
No. There was nothing set up for reserve pilots. They had a plane out at Warren Robins that you could and go through a bunch of rigmarole, and they would let pilots use it more or less an hour or thing. But I tried that, but that was too much mess to do. Now I'll tell you a sad thing. My wife of all these years, yesterday was the one year anniversary. She died 1 year ago.
This looks like some of the old airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
Is this where they're at today, I guess? Or
I don't know.
Probably still out there.
I'll finish that other story, if you don't mind listening to all this rambling.
Yeah.
Okay. The plane that my friend was able to crash land and get out of, which was unusual. And then they, like I said, they went down the river till they got to the coast, and then they were picked up down there. The Australians found it. And they resurrected it.
They pulled it up out of the...
Got it out of the jungle.
Wow.
In fact, I was talking to one of them. What they did, they brought a big helicopter in, and it wouldn't pick it up.
Too heavy, huh?
Too heavy. And so what they did, and I don't know how they did it, they took the engines off, and they took out both engines, picked them up, of course. And one of the good parts about it, see, he was out of gas, and the thing didn't burn.
It was just sitting there.
They're just sitting there all those years. And a few years back, not about 3 or 4 years ago, they contacted the fella that was in it, was flying it. There was one of my tent mates, and he went to over there. They asked him over to come over to Australia to fly it.
To fly the airplane?
They had it flying. They had it flying.
And that airplane is still there in
Australia?
It's
still there. Uh-huh.
Well, I know you just made a lot of people's day telling that story.
Yeah. But I really think with everything, it was the association with the people you were with. That's the only thing you could get. The only thing that you could even get you through anything like this is having friends that were there and you living with them and knowing them and all like that. And of the ones that were together, we finally wound up together, the five of us. And we flew in the same flights. That's one thing. You could almost do that if you were flying. You tell the CO you wanted to fly. And they got to know who liked to fly with who.
They put you all up together then.
Yeah, because I did 68 missions. And I'm amazed that I wasn't shot down anymore. I was hit, but it never...
Well, the A-20 would always bring you back, wouldn't it? If you were nice to it, I guess.
Yes. If you... I'll keep talking one more time, then I'm going to shut up. My plane, I had the best crew chief on the line. Everybody did. Everyone was the best.
Everyone was the best.
But mine was the best. And one reason why the CO, the colonel, didn't have a plane. Group. He would pick planes to fly if he wanted to fly, which he did on every mission. he picked my plane most of the time because he knew I had a good crew chief and looked after things. And we were flying, they had some crazy idea, I don't know how they got it, but they wanted some higher level droppings. So we went up at 5,000 feet and we were loaded, and they had a B-25, which is a twin-engine bomber, slide bomber. And when we got to the target, which we didn't know, but we toggled out. When we saw them, when they saw their bomb bay doors open, we started toggling our plane, our bombs out. As I turned back, let my bombs go, and started down to get back into some sort of formation, both my engines cut out.
And then what?
then it was. We had a little communication, and Steve had a gunner, and I knew we had 200 miles to go back. But by that time, we were out of formation anyway, because I couldn't keep up as I was coming down. So I called and I said, "You want to go home or go down?" Which meant crash in the water. He said, "Let's go home." And we put that thing and we went home in it. But two engines cutting out, so you flew on separate gas fleets when you were going over the target, especially. So we got back, and they checked, and they checked, and they checked, and they couldn't find out. And I was taking off one day, and as I came up, and both engines cut out again. Luckily, there was another field there, and I hadn't reached takeoff speed anyway, hardly. I was just off the ground. So both engines cut off. So I called, did it again, took it, and told them that it cut off. And there were three of us still there. And they called us in the colonel's thing. They said, "Okay, y'all's time is up now. And I've got a position for being the head of a squadron or something like that. I'll give you your choice. You want to go home or stay here? Go home. You want to go home or stay here? Go home. Want to go home? Stay home." So we all came home.
And pretty easy decision, wasn't it?
It was. And after that, I'm having so many sad things. My plane was in such good shape and all. It was a sort of a thing. One of the best. They lost it going to the Philippines. When they were moving, our group moved from New Guinea to the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And on the way up, they lost it. And then they went in the water, and of course that did it. And I have wondered through the years if it was did the same thing with that pilot that it did with me, and he cut off and he just wasn't high enough to do anything.
But you could never figure out why it was doing that, though.
They went over it, and my crew chief was the best one on the line. Of course, everybody had the best one, but mine was. And we never did find. And of course, he was on the plane. Mm-hmm. Because when we moved, we let him the single cockpit and all, of course. But the gunner was in the back, and then there was a crawl space right at the top of the underneath the cockpit thing that goes up, and you could lie down there, and they'd fly that way with us. which was strictly against the rules, but you didn't have rules when you doing something like this. So I've been curious to know. I never know, of course, if the same thing happened, did both engines cut iron again. Mm.
But, did they survive the crash, or were they were all
they're
killed?
Gone. Mm. They were gone. And with a crash and having somebody, see, they were back up in here, mm-hmm. lying down, and they were, that was one of the rules that you did, was not to fly like that. Mm. But the men, the mechanics, and how you took mechanics that half of them couldn't even drive a car good, to put them over there and all that stuff and have those engines flying, it was a miracle anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know how they did it. If you do and have to go to service, make the best of it. Because it'll be an experience you'll never get anywhere. And just go ahead and grit your teeth and have as good a time as you can. Because it's remarkable there, as I said, and I still think so, that they take these people that have, half of them didn't know one wreck from another. See, even a lot of the boys couldn't drive automobiles. A lot of the boys that I met, their families didn't have cars. Now, see, down here, we were fooling with Model Ts and all our lives. But some people that lived in New York, they couldn't even drive a car. And they put them out here flying and doing, working on them.
Well, thank you for your service, Mr. Cassidy.
Well, I've enjoyed it. I'm glad you came. And I'm glad I had. I'll take a quick look at this book. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think those pictures neat. I just love those pictures.
That's all the time we have for this episode, but for pictures of our visit, just log on to Warbird Radio and search for the Edward Cassidy story. Inside, you'll find pictures of Mr. Cassidy and his airplane. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned. There's more Warbird Radio coming up right after this.